But to try to house people is very expensive. The government doesn't want any part of it. They tried housing. Housing doesn't work when government gets involved at any time. And you can go back to some earlier days in this country when, with all the housing that they tried to set up, but then you set it up wrong. You just can't set up housing, like I said earlier. You just can't put people in housing that have issues and walk away from them. You're setting them up for future failure because you just can't walk away because they need help. They were needing help when usually they moved into that apartment or that housing unit. And if you walk away, you've just started the process of getting them back on track, getting their lives restored.
Welcome to Your Story Doesn't End Here, the mental health podcast of military and veterans who refuse to be silenced. I'm your host, Rachel, and my mission with this podcast is to be a voice for those who don't have a voice, bring awareness to mental health issues, provide value and solutions, and to change the culture when it comes to mental health within the DoD organizations. Hey everyone, thank you so much for coming back for another episode of Your Story Doesn't End Here. Today's guest is Dale Mullen, who is the president and founder of Warrior Homes of Collier. He is a small town Kansas native. Dale grew up in Kansas City, Kansas, and entered the military at 19 years old, serving 3 years in Vietnam as a personnel specialist. After graduating from the University of Kansas, he then worked for 30 years at the Fortune 500 company Avon, ascending to the position of Global Director of Logistics and Transportation. Following his corporate career, Dale retired and relocated to Naples, Florida. Quickly tiring of golf and fishing, he turned his focus to community service, creating Warrior Homes of Collier in 2014. Dale, thank you so much for being on the show today.
Thank you, Rachel, for having me. My pleasure. Talk about something that's very, very dear to my heart is veterans.
Yes, I love it. And I'm so excited to hear about what you're doing. And I'm excited to pass it off for you to tell more to the listeners. But before we get into that today, just to kind of start our episode off to gauge kind of mood and how you're feeling today, if you could describe how you are coming into this space today in this episode, your emotions in one word or a couple words, how would you describe that?
Passionate.
I love it.
Very much so. And looking forward for this opportunity to talk about a very important need that our veterans are experiencing today.
Issues. Passionate is an incredible way to set the tone for this. So Dale, I'm going to pass it off to you to just tell the listeners a little bit more about yourself, your background, and how you got into what you are doing with Warrior Homes of Collier.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Rachel. I think you did a good job in introducing me, a little bit of background, who I am, what I do today. I am retired, but from my career, but not retired from life. I enjoy what I'm doing, what energizes me, keeps me motivated to get up every day, because we really feel like we're making a difference in the lives of so many veterans that are across the spectrum of anyone from the age of the earliest veterans that are coming back from today's wars that are in their, let's say, early 30s to veterans that are, I think the oldest veteran that I work with is about 89 years old. So it's a wide spectrum. And veterans have various needs like all of us have in life. The needs that we have when we're in our 30s versus the needs we have when we retire are totally different from a health standpoint, as well as housing and other needs that you might have in your lifetime. And where those needs surface and how they reach out for help varies by veteran. And I find that veterans in general tend to be very proud people. They have served. Their mission usually is about helping others, you know, showing up to rescue others, defend others, protect this nation. And for them to get to a point in life where they are in need for somebody to help them is not easy. And I find that that's a very common thing that I find. And when they do talk about needs and you say, well, here's what I can do for you, they usually don't want to take everything that you have. They say, well, leave something for somebody else, or I'm not worthy enough. Somebody else is probably more in need than I am. Give it to them. And I often say, no. I can't think of anyone that's more in need of somebody who needs help, is hungry, needs a place to sleep, needs a bed, needs food, whatever it is that's more deserving than you are when you're somebody who was willing to raise your right hand and to swear to stand between us citizens and in the evil in the world, protect our freedom. And to me, how do you not be able to rationalize that and say, you know what, I'll give you everything I have. Even you need a shirt, I'll take the shirt off my back, you know, if need be, to help you out if you're in need. So, and that tends to be really my passion. And when you see the need out there, and also the willingness of folks that we run into that within our community that are willing to help. You know, I say, you don't really have to sell. You just have to tell people about the need. There are veterans that are living in our community that need help. And when you explain that to folks, usually they're ready to say, hey, well, how can I help? What do you need? Find it very, very helpful.
So why homelessness? Why that? Of all the issues that are affecting the veteran community, and you and I know that there's quite a bit, why did you specifically hone in on the topic of homelessness?
Well, it started out on more mental health related is where it really started out, in dealing with veterans that were current day veterans that were post 9/11 who are coming back from combat, overseas tours, dealing with PTSD or traumatic brain injury, that were having mental health related issues. And a lot of the impact of a lot of that, ramifications of a lot of that, ends up in homelessness. And it usually, a lot of it ends up being related to substance use and mental health related, and homelessness always ends up being a major component of that. Very, very common theme. When you hit the bottom, when you spend all your money, when your family has disowned, I wouldn't say disowned you, or your family certainly has had enough of you, ended a lot of relationships, jobs, family related. What happens is they end up in a state of homelessness. And 50% of all veterans have a 50% are more likely to become homeless, 50% of the veteran population. So it's likely to become more homeless than the average population. And 2% of them, I would say, end up being something like 22% end up committing suicide in this country. So you have suicide rates, homeless rates being two things that pretty much work in common. Usually got some mental health issues, a high percentage of them are homeless. And I think that statistically, it's like 90%. Of all homeless people have some level of mental health issue. And so homelessness ends up being a common thing. And normally, if you can't fix the homeless issue, then you can't work on the other parts of somebody's needs that they might have that has to do with mental health, shelter, food, all those other things that go along with it.
Right. It goes back to those basic human needs. If we're in survival mode, how can we really focus on the other things? And most people don't focus on therapy when they don't have shelter over their head. So I love that kind of starting with mental health led you to that. So it sounds like you don't just give veterans shelter and then leave them alone. You also provide other support services.
Yeah, absolutely. If you don't have a structure around housing, your housing programs, then the person will fail if you don't have structure around it. Structure meaning that all of the other key components of services that are needed that will help support that person in getting their life restored. If you don't have those, they'll fail. Because housing alone is not the answer. You see a lot of folks talking about on TV and newspaper articles and all that, we're doing is providing housing. We're housing people. I'll tell you what, that's not enough. You got to provide other services because, as I said earlier, 90% of all homeless people have some level of mental health disorder. Now, that doesn't mean it's permanent. That doesn't mean that they are dangerous to anybody, but it doesn't take long for somebody to come homeless that all of a sudden you develop some mental health issues, a lot of self-esteem, depression, a lot of things like that that are a result of that because you just don't have shelter. You know, you just don't have shelter. And that is such a key component. And then you get into the areas of addiction, substance use. If you don't have, usually we've got programs that are called transitional housing for veterans that need transitional help during the time that they're in recovery. And housing is an important part of that component. It's an absolute important part. And our housing, we have different levels of housing that's on a spectrum from what you would call rapid housing, where somebody sleeping in their car, they're sleeping on the bench, they need to be housed immediately. That program is called rapid housing, where you put them into a motel or you put them into a shelter just to get them off the street, get them out of the weather, get them into housing. And then you get into what the next transition would be, what's called transitional housing, the next level. And that's where they stay a period of time. In our houses, about an average of 7 months they stay until they get a job. They can get back on their feet. We don't necessarily charge them rent. Depends on how much they have, if they have any income. Get them back on their feet. And then we move them into what is called long-term supportive housing, where they get a job. Maybe they can't afford to pay 100% of the rent, but they get into group housing where they pay a portion of their rent so that they can get on with their life. And then ultimately, they move into permanent housing where they get an apartment of their own, a house of their own, and get on with their life. So it's on a continuum from rapid housing to permanent housing. And a lot of people talk about affordable housing, and they don't understand that more affordable housing tends to be workforce housing. We're talking about a group of folks here that is below workforce housing. They don't even have a job, you know, but you got to get them housed.
So it's interesting that we're having this conversation right now about housing, and you talk about these models that are working for people. And I want to hear more in a second about the, if you have them, I guess, the statistics, or, you know, if people tend to be successful after going through this program, or if people come back to where they started. But the reason I say this is an interesting topic of discussion is because in my area where I live, Whidbey Island, Washington, this is a huge topic right now of housing and homelessness. And what do we do? And you talk about affordable housing, and that's a huge topic of discussion. You know, people don't want to put money or resources or pick a specific location for workforce housing, because a lot of people know that just giving people housing isn't the answer, because it's not giving them the tools that they need to actually change the root source of the problem, which a lot of times I'm assuming is that people just, they know what they know and they don't know what they don't know. And just giving them housing isn't changing the lifestyle or giving them the support that they need to actually get them out of the situation that they're in. And so they kind of, you know, would essentially be held in this like continuous cycle of this lifestyle. And the housing is only just checking one very small box out of the huge, huge, you know, situation that someone actually needs help with. And so kind of circling back to what I briefly mentioned a little bit ago, what success stories do you have, or do you have statistics to show that this model of helping people and supporting them with these different phases of housing, as opposed to just giving them a shelter over their head, that it works?
It's a good question. We have statistics on the transitional housing part, which is where people come in with some level of substance use disorder, where they're trying to get their life back on track. And this is a transitional house that people would you might think probably more commonly called a sober house, where they usually come from a treatment program, where they've been into either some most common is probably a 28-day type minimum of a in-house treatment program, where they've been detoxed, go through a treatment, and then they are released into what you would call a transitional house. And transitional houses are houses that, while they work on their recovery program, a lot of times, most commonly, it's called 90 days, 90 meetings, 90 days, where they will go to 90 AA or UA or 90 days of program support every day while they're getting their life back in order, getting a job, that type of thing, going through whether it's a day program, night programs, getting their relationships a lot of times restored with their family and all. And that takes time, and it's not an overnight event. And we find the average stay is about 7 months is what it takes. We have defined as an 86% success rate. And that's awful high. And the reason that I think it's high is for two primary reasons. One is you have people living in that transitional house that are like-minded. They're all veterans. You know, they come in there, they've had success in their life. They've served in the military. They understand discipline. They understand what it means to achieve an objective and have you know, goals, that type of thing. They know how to take orders. So you have someone that's has some experience with this type of living, and even living in a group home or living in a barracks. And so because of that, statistics say that there's a better chance of success. So you have that working for you. And then the other thing is, when they come in, we don't make any demands of them in terms of, hey, you got to start paying $100 or $200 or $300 a week. When they come in, we've had veterans come into our transitional house from veterans, what was called Veterans Treatment Court, which they come right out of jail with nothing but a pair of pajamas and a dead cell phone. They come into our house, they don't even have to pay anything at all until they get a job, get to work, and then we start working with them on a budget and then figuring out what they can afford to pay. They get their driver's license back, get a car, and as I said, they get a job and they move on with their life. And it takes about 7 months on an average for that to all fall into place. It doesn't happen overnight. And you got to have a family, you got to have a support system around them to make that happen. And those that really are successful are usually the ones that have a support system around them. If you don't, then they're more likely to fail, is if they don't have that support system.
What is the physical footprint of all, because you mentioned several different facilities, right? You know, the transitional, you have the, I don't remember all the names of them. You'd probably know them because this is your script. But you mentioned several different buildings, I guess, or support systems. What is the physical footprint of all this? Is this like a very large?
They vary. The transitional house is a house that has seven beds. It's in a neighborhood. It's got seven beds, two veterans per bed. And then we have a kind of a house squad leader that overlooks the operation on a 24/7 basis. And there's two veterans per bed. And according to the best practices, because of the nature of what they're recovering from, it's very important that they have two per room, and they're twin beds. And they, isolation tends to be a very common issue with people that have either depression or drug use. So two in a room forces them to start interacting with people, other humans, which is very important. So that's the transitional house, and it's just in a neighborhood. You don't, it's not in a clinic. It's not in a jail. It's just in a regular neighborhood. If you drove by that house, you wouldn't even know that it's a transitional house. You just think it's another nice looking house in the neighborhood, but that's where they live. And it's in an area where a central part of town where they can get around with public transportation. And there's businesses around where they can get jobs. Very, very important. And they're close to the VA. Because they're going to be interacting a lot with the VA, and whether they're riding the bike or taking public transportation, they're close to the VA services. That's what is called a transitional house.
Okay. I was going to ask, what about the other ones that you had mentioned?
The other houses are what is called long-term supportive housing. And these vary by single family homes that have three bedrooms, veteran in each bedroom, and they have a bathroom that they, most of them have two baths in them, and they share a common area, and that's called long-term supportive housing. And we have three other properties like that. Most recent one we opened up is a apartment complex that has 10 apartment units. It's got two bedrooms per unit, so we house 20 veterans in there. We're a small community. You know, Naples, Florida population, when it's not in season, is a little less than 400,000 people. So we're a small community. When we did our count, when we did a homeless count a few years ago, we only had a total of about 97 estimate. We had about 97 homeless veterans living in our community. So we're not overwhelmed. So it's a fixable problem in our community, something we can get our hands around and begin to fix, but it's expensive. Housing is expensive. And the overall, when you start talking about homelessness, you know, it's not a topic that most people want to talk about. And there's a stigma, you know, associated with homelessness. And we've, in our country, you know, we have become, I think, really politicized homelessness more today than we ever have. And if you, you're a sanctuary city, or you're a city that provides homelessness people to put up a tent and live, then you must be a different color, you know, between red and blue. You know what I'm talking about. And that's the sad part, because who suffers are those that are most in need. Why we politicize it.
Yeah, I think a big issue in my community when it comes to homelessness is, you know, a lot of times the local government or organizations or just individual people, they're like, oh, well, we don't have a homeless shelter. So, you know, people just pull their RV or their car on the side of the road. But then now again, there's no support. And so it just perpetuates an issue without providing the support that people need. And then oftentimes people do, they go to that clinical side of things, back to kind of the overarching mental health issue that exists in the country, which is, oh, we don't have enough psychiatrists. We don't have enough psychologists. What do? I don't know. We just kind of rack our brains about the same things over and over. And so that's why I think it's so interesting that you have created this model that has such an incredible success rate. But what that key feature of putting like-minded people with like-minded people, instead of just creating this like homeless shelter where people can just show up and like, yeah, there may be resources, but it's not providing support specific to that person's needs. Do you have any plans of expanding outside of your area with what you're doing?
I wish we could. The answer to that is no. And the reason that I say no is the lack of funding. In our community, we live in a very expensive community. We're here in Naples, Florida. And the cost per bed to house somebody here is $120,000 per bed, a fixed cost to house somebody. Now, that's cheap compared to some other parts of the country, but it's still higher than other parts of the country. I mean, there was a number I saw the other day, was quoted in San Francisco, for example. They're setting up these paved parking lots, and it said the city is costing the city about $160,000 the cost per tent to put somebody on one of these spaces in a parking lot. $160,000, just a piece of blacktop. In LA, I read an article a few months ago that they're over $1 million per bed to open up a facility to put somebody in the LA, you know, area of California. And so you can go, you know, and you can go, if you go to some other parts of the country, it could be a lot less than what it's costing us here, $120. But it's all sized based upon the economics of your community, but it's still expensive in any way you look at it. Housing is expensive. The number one thing that we face in this country across the board is housing in general, and the high price of housing. Your generation, for example, you know, housing in your generation versus when I was your age, it was affordable and it was attainable. But now housing for young couples, young families, is almost ownership. And I'm talking about particularly is almost out of reach right now for a lot of young families. And that's very sad. And we don't have time to talk about why, but it's the reality of the world we live in here today. But to try to house people is very expensive. The government doesn't want any part of it. They tried housing. Housing doesn't work when government gets involved at any time. And you can go back to some earlier days in this country when with all the housing that they tried to set up, but then you set it up wrong. You just can't set up housing, like I said earlier. You just can't put people in housing that have issues and walk away from them. It's you're setting them up for future failure because you just can't walk away because they need help. They were needing help when usually they moved into that apartment or that housing unit, and if you walk away, you've just started the process of getting them back on track, getting their lives restored.
Yeah, absolutely, and understood. Talking about the price of housing, I mean, here in Washington State, it's absolutely insane. And I'm from the Midwest originally. I'm from Iowa. I still have family in Iowa. And I look at the price of buying a house in Iowa compared to the price of buying the same size house in Washington. And it's just night and day. And so, you know, it's not surprising to hear that places like California, it is in the millions or, you know, $160,000 for a slab of blacktop somewhere, which sounds inhumane, honestly, at the end of the day, to charge that much for a slab of blacktop. Hopefully they're providing more services than just a tent on a piece of blacktop, but I don't know. And, you know, again, we don't have...
Well, it's all the support services they have around. They got to rent the property. You know, it's the rent a parking lot, which is probably not very, you know, it's probably very expensive in the inner city. Set up all the services around that, sanitation, water and everything else they're providing, it gets to be very expensive to provide any support services when it comes for people to live. And there's just not a lot of money available to do it. There's not a lot of will to do it. And, you know, one of the things that going back to what I mentioned before about the stigma, you know, people think that all homeless people are lazy. There are homeless people that work. They just don't make enough money to buy a place to live. Or they're doubling up in apartment units, or they're doubling up sleeping in cars or all kinds of places because they don't have enough money to rent something or to buy something. And because of the wage, and we know about minimum wage, and the veterans that we're seeing today, these older veterans, and we didn't talk much about the seniors, a little bit about that, but the seniors are the most vulnerable, one of the other vulnerable populations right now. And the Wall Street Journal did an article back in September. They came down to even Florida and as they were doing a national review of the homeless situation here in our country. And what better place to do it was in South Florida, where all a lot of retirees live. And they called it the silver tsunami. It's now happening, and it's hitting the baby boom. It's hitting the boomers that were born back in the 40s that now are at a point in time in their life where they're on. A lot of these that we run into are seniors that are in their way past 65 years old. The average age is about 72. Their average income, Social Security income, is about $1,200 a month. That's it. That's it. For whatever reason, that's the financial situation they're in. You cannot rent, in our community, you cannot rent a one-bedroom apartment for anything less than about $1,700 to $1,800 a month where we live here in South Florida. So you're already forcing a huge percentage of the elderly population, whether they're male or female, into a homelessness. And I don't know. And that's I think, is probably starting to prevail throughout the country from what I understand. And we have that problem right here where we live.
Yeah, I know, especially during COVID timeframe, Florida was one of those states that got hit really hard with hiking the rental prices to just insane amounts. And I was curious, for especially for seniors, is there not...
Well, we not only got hit with that, but we also got hit with Ian. So we got hit with hurricanes.
Yeah.
And those two things up and down the west coast of Florida have really reduced property capacity, and as well as Ian. So
yeah, that too. Is there not, for seniors specifically, since we're on this topic, is there senior housing that is more affordable, or is the senior housing even at that $1,600 to $1,700 a month rate?
Right.
Wow.
The issues we have where we live is there's just a lack of public housing and low-cost housing here in this community, and no really very, very little Section 8 housing. And there's all kinds of land usage and density issues that provide protection, you know, for those that want to keep property values up and keep a lot of people moving in to your community, population growth, trying to restrict the population growth. So they really don't spend a lot of money on social services here in this part of Florida.
So then my question would be, if we know that rent is at a certain capacity and you're providing these services to be able to help people get on their own feet, get a job established, get rentals, how do we get to that point where people can afford this rent that seems to be unaffordable for most people? Are you helping place them into better paying jobs, or for seniors, are they getting access to more resources, or where are you, if you're able to, I guess, filling that gap to help people get to a point where they're able to sustain themselves on their own?
Well, you can help the younger veterans. Get a number of them now that go through the transitional houses are either going to school, college for the first time, or getting their master's degree in areas that they know, understand now they can make money in, or they're going to trade schools and things like that. So you're helping them become more competitive, you know, so they in the community which they live get better jobs and that type of thing. So yes, we help them do that. That's part of the supporting services that you try to provide around them is so they can improve their income levels.
Yeah. And then what Definitely. About for the senior population that you can't really send them to like a school or anything because a lot of them are in that retirement age? Is there anything?
Well, there's not a lot you can do. What you try to do is provide housing that the government doesn't provide. You try to provide housing that the average, I just read the paper here the other day, the average medium house here where we live right now is a little over $600,000 a year. I mean, that's what it costs, the average selling price of a house. And the average medium income where we live here is about $90,000 a year. So when you look at that competing with people at the far end of the spectrum income level that fall into folks that are below the minimum level, whether they're working or not working, you're talking about probably half the population here who are really working at a wage below the poverty level. And what we're doing for our housing, we do a formula that's pretty common in the housing industry in this area of providing supportive housing. Is you charge them 30% of their gross income, okay? And their income has to be no more than 50% of the average medium income for a single individual. So here, the average medium income of 50% is about $25,000 to $28,000, something like that, a year. And then we'll charge them no more than 30% of their gross income. So first of all, to qualify, they can't be making more than $25,000 or $30,000 a year, live in that housing. And then whatever their income is, we will not charge them more than 30% of their gross income, which is a pretty good rule of thumb. And so you're getting rental payments on these group homes. A guy's paying on an average of about almost $400 a month. About $100 a week is all they're having to pay. And so when you're only have an income of $1,200, that it leaves you another, $500 to $800 a month to live on. And what we do in addition to that is food is like in a lot of areas, there's a lot of people that need food. So there's a lot of food banks around that provide food for these individuals, including veterans that fall into this category as well. So there's a lot of food banks. Thank God for food banks.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's awesome that you're in a position that you're able to provide so much support to people aside from just, kind of like we mentioned several times, the shelter, and then here you're on your own. This is all we can provide for you. And I know you're not looking to expand necessarily, but I think the model, if it would be duplicatable, would be an incredible model to share through other places in the country that are trying to figure out veteran homelessness or just homelessness in general. So I'm so, so appreciative that you just took the time to share what you're doing and what's working in your area and what you've put your heart and soul into as your passion. Where can people find you and how can they best support what you are doing with?
Well, we have a website and it's www.collier.org. Stands for what it is, www.collier.org, collier.org is how you can go check out our website, see what we're doing. There's a lot of information on our website and we find that's just a great, way to get the message out. And there's a donate page on there if you want to donate to help what we're doing here in Collier County. We'll answer any emails that we get. Anybody that has an interest in talking to us about what we're doing, want to learn. I mean, it's transportable what we do. It's nothing breakthrough. It's just a lot of folks determined, dedicated, have a heart and a passion. Most of the people that are involved with us are either a veteran, they have a relative who is a veteran, or they're very patriotic that really care about helping others. And thank God we have in our community a lot of folks like that.
For someone who needs the services that you provide, what's the best way for them to get in contact with you? Same way.
Yeah, you can go to info@wwcollier.org and send an email, and I guarantee you somebody will answer it. We have quite a few organizations that we collaborate with here, which is another part we never even talked about. This whole area is such a major, I would say, effort that you cannot do it alone. And we collaborate with about 18 other organizations here in our county that help us provide surround services for veterans. And so if you contact us through info@wwcollier.org, we can put people in touch with other veteran services in our community that whatever the need may, it could be helping with rent, it could be helping with utilities. Sometimes they're cell phones. We help, as long as you're a veteran and you serve your country. We don't deal with anyone with a dishonorable discharge. But otherwise than that, otherwise, we will help every veteran that gives us a call. Our goal is to ensure that no veteran is left behind in our community.
I love that. And I hope that people that are listening to this episode do at least check out what you're doing, share what you're doing. And if you're in a position and you're listening to this and you can donate, please consider donating. Causes like this, especially the local community causes that aren't necessarily in national news. I mean, where we start making a difference is in our own communities. And so this is very near and dear to my heart because it is a community that has decided to step up. How do we collaborate? How do we support the veterans in our community that need it the most and make a difference? So Dale, I am absolutely just impressed and amazed and so in support of what you are doing down there in Florida. In any way that I can help spread the word, you know, mainly with this podcast or sharing it and telling people to share it, I'm all about it. So Dale, are there any last words or pieces of advice that you want to leave the listeners with today before we wrap up?
Support a veteran. You know, I think that so many people think, and some veterans to thank them for their service, pat them on the back is enough, but sometimes it's not enough. And really make sure that you really support the veterans more than just pat them on the back and thank them for their service. If you see one in need, give them a helping hand, because a lot of them are looking for a hand up, not a handout. And that's what I would say. Give them a hand up, those that are in need.
Thank you for taking the time to listen in today. With your support, we are able to increase awareness of the mental health issues affecting service members and veterans today with the goal of creating positive change. If you got value from this episode, please take 30 seconds to subscribe and share this episode within your own network. Until next time, remember, your story matters, your mental health matters, and your story doesn't end here.